Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we spend time and get to know Rex Salisbury, who is based in the Bay Area and is the founder and general partner of Cambrian and Cambrian Ventures, a community and fund that invests in seed and pre-seed opportunities in fintech across the U.S. Rex, thanks for joining us today. It's great to have you on board. We were recently introduced through a common friend, so I'm very excited to learn more about your fund and you personally. So let's start with Cambria. Tell us about what it is.
Cambrian.
Cambrian. I'm sorry. That's great.
That's okay.
And so tell us about how you started this effort and what you're all about.
Yeah, first, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. So my story, I think, starts in a way that's not that unfamiliar for a lot of people. End up both in tech, but especially in fintech, that the first job I ever had was as an investment banker at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Learned a lot, totally hate it. So I quit my job, drove cross country, taught myself to code, became a software engineer. So I still informs a lot of my thinking about the financial services ecosystem and what are opportunities that are ripe for disruption or improvement. But I by no means wanted to make a decade plus career in an industry full of inefficiencies and a lot of very unhappy people.
Got it. So you're focused on fintech investments, right? Was it the banking background that got you interested in that? Like, how did you migrate into this path?
Yeah. So I think going way back, started off in banking, and specifically what I did informed why I was excited about trying to find people who are doing things differently. So I'm on the East Coast. I'm structuring these $200 to $2 billion credit facilities where there's basically a 200-page credit agreement underlying it. You really only tweak two or three terms in that agreement. But for some reason, despite having a decade-long relationship with the customer, you take about 90 days to do it. It takes five bankers on your end. There's a syndicate of five banks who each have their own five bankers, and it takes 60 lawyers between all the banks, and they get like to do very basic stuff. And you're like sitting in financial markets, like, this is insane. This is the current state of affairs for how you actually get a transaction done. And so I'm sitting up here at the very top of the stack, which is like these really large debt facilities being structured in my case for publicly traded real estate companies. Meanwhile, you're looking at people like Lending Club getting started who are basically automating the origination of consumer unsecured credit. So very small, low value, but high volume transactions. And they're doing it completely online, without any sort of human interaction or very lightweight or infrequent human interaction. And you're like, wow, that's completely different. I think my industry is going to change. It's probably going to take 10 years before it does, because it's going to start with the low value, high volume transactions and then creep its way up the stack. And in fact, that was already happening after Lending Club. The next thing that kind of happened was SoFi. So now you're going from these very small consumer loans to student loans. And then my genius idea was like, I'm going to become a software engineer. I'm going to work on mortgage because I think that's going to be like the next step up. Turns out mortgage is like really hard for a whole bunch of reasons we don't need to go into. But watching how technology was changing things and seeing the way in which it was just banks were going to be completely ineffective in terms of adopting it for all sorts of how they are operating is why I got really excited about basically going and pursuing a completely different career. So this is over a decade ago now, but that's why I moved to the West Coast, became a software engineer, joined a great team that was building a direct consumer mortgage company called Syndio. I worked under the CTO, who was a former co-founder of SoFi, and helped build a fully automated online mortgage pre-approval. If you remember the whole like rocket push button, get mortgage Super right. Bowl ad circa 2014, 2015, which got a lot of blowback because people were like, didn't we just have a problem where like it was too easy to get a mortgage? The thing I built was basically what the Rocket and the Quicket team had built as well in terms of being able to quickly go through and get an application. And actually being able to get an application quickly has nothing to do with whether or not it's risk or lending too much to anyone or too high of risk, and everything to do with just automating the data collection and gathering. But that didn't work out. And so as I started building software in mortgage in downtown San Francisco, circa 2014, 2015, I was like, I just want to talk to other people who are building interesting things. And that was the real genesis of Cambrian, which was originally a community for founders and builders in fintech to come together and talk about things that they were working on. And so I basically started organizing small monthly events in downtown San Francisco. Those started growing over time. So Cambr and the community grew to the point where we have 20,000 newsletter subscribers, 5,000 meetup members doing monthly events in San Francisco and New York, doing quarterly job fairs, biannual co-founder matching, biannual summits, and then pulled me into investing advising. This was all while I still had my day job. And I realized I was getting a lot more energy from the ecosystem. So I quit my day job. I went full-time on the community, which was effectively an events business at that point, with the intention of raising a fund to support more of the investing I've been doing in a formalized way. And that's when the Andreessen Horowitz team reached out, who I'd gotten to know through the work I'd done with the Cambrian community. Right. And like, why don't you help us build the fintech practice? So I helped build the fintech practice at A16Z. And I was basically the first partner brought on externally. They'd had two other folks who were awesome internally. And then the investing team grew from there and did. But after 2 years of being there, learned a lot, had a great time, really liked my colleagues there. I basically wanted to get back to my roots, which was all along I had planned to launch my own fund, focused on pre-seed and seed, have a heavily network-driven approach in terms of how I think about investing. And so that's what I did is after 2 years, spun out, done my own thing. And now I have Cambrian Ventures, which is just north of a $20 million pre-seed and seed focused fintech fund that is in part powered by the Cambrian community that I've built over the last 5 to 6 years. And one way that manifests itself is as investors in my fund, I have 20 of the top founders in fintech, founders from places like SoFi, Plaid, Blend, the list goes on across all sorts of different areas like financial infrastructure, mortgage, real estate, wealth tech, the list goes on. So that's where I am. And then I guess to fully catch you up since launching the fund, I've got 15 investments done so far, 100% pre-seed and seed companies with US go-to-markets. So not necessarily teams based here. A lot of the teams are based internationally, but the preponderance of their go-to-market is usually selling something to someone in the US.
You obviously are very passionate about fintech. That comes through. So what do you think are the most interesting current trends within the sector? And what do you think the future of fintech looks like?
Yeah, so the most exciting thing for me is just the quality of the talent in the ecosystem. So if you back up like 10 years and you think about the very first entrepreneurs who are coming in fintech, they're probably people coming from tech who didn't understand finance or coming from finance, but they didn't understand tech. If you fast forward 10 years, you now have a whole bunch of people, whether they're founders or kind of serial operators who understand both of those from kind of first principles because they've actually built, they've either been finance people building tech businesses and now they kind of understand what that looks like, or they've been tech people building in finance and learning through a lot of brain damage how financial services actually operate. And so one is just there's so many more smart people who understand how to bring these two things together. And then two, the infrastructure to go out and be able to build and launch things has gotten a lot better. Both the like kind of raw infrastructure of, hey, there are 20 banking as a service platforms you could use to embed some kind of banking on, as well as the informal infrastructure of there are now 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 fintech focused venture funds, whereas 10 years ago, most people didn't even have a fintech partner, let alone a fintech practice, let alone a firm dedicated to investing in fintech. One way you can bring that to life is imagine you're John Stein, you're building Betterment in 2009, you're in downtown New York, and you're like, okay, like, who do I hire? It's like, I don't know. You go to a developer inside the bank, banks employ a lot of developers. Turns out like someone who works at a bank probably isn't a great person to start a company with. So ends up, his co-founder ends up being somebody he met through playing poker and this, okay, like I've got a team, I've got an idea. Who do I pitch? Well, I don't know. Like they're really like what, I'll talk to some venture people, but they like don't necessarily, the term robo-advisory isn't a term for another like 4 years. The term fintech isn't a term for another 5 years. So it's, I don't really know who to pitch. And they're like, okay, now I need to build it. What do I launch it on? And you're like, oh, I don't know. And then like, fortunately, there was this thing called Apex that people could go out and use to launch like broker services, but they were one of the very first people to build on that, especially for the kind of robo advisory model. And now if you fast forward 10 years and someone like John or anyone else goes out and wants to build something, it's, oh, who do I hire? I've worked at 3 different companies over the years. I can think through what I'm building, who is like the right roster to put together. Who do I raise from? I actually have interacted with 100 investors who invest in fintech over the years. How do I build it? Well, now there are, you know, 20 different platforms I could be thinking about. And so that's just a complete sea change in the last decade in terms of how capable the entrepreneurs are and the tools that are available to them and the talent that's available to them to go out and tackle problems. And the market is literally the same size it's always been. If you think about digital penetration in financial services, it's still insanely low. And so you've got better people with better tools, the same market opportunity as ever before. That's why I'm excited about fintech. It's like, there's still so much work to be done. And we're just getting started. And the people the people are much smarter and more capable than they have been in the past.
Yeah, and fintech was obviously high flyer in the 2021 timeframe and then lost a bunch of steam. Like, how do you think about that? I guess you mentioned a little bit about penetration, and the penetration is still really low, so there's a long way to go. How do you think about the current climate? Are there too many startups pursuing too few opportunities, or do you still think that there's a long way to go to realize the potential?
Yeah, the venture ecosystem is not any one given thing. So there are definitely categories within fintech that have gotten crowded and have been pretty challenged. So you talked about public market corrections. And if you look at the last decade of companies that came out in fintech, there have been some really great kind of infrastructure oriented ones, Stripes for payments, Plaid for bank data. But a lot of the other ones are more consumer oriented, like the Lending Clubs, the Robinhoods, the Credit Karmas. I spend a lot of time now in B2B. And when you start to get into kind of the B2B arena of financial services, there are all sorts of markets that are very opaque and non-obvious to outsiders. And so I have backed multiple companies for which I have not heard of another team trying to build something in that space for quite a while. And it's not like there are 5 or 10 other people who want to go and build something like that, because there are very few other teams who are qualified. But these are actually quite large markets, large opportunities, and super interesting. That said, there are other areas like consumer neobanks, where there are 10, 20, 30, 100 different neobanks, in part because there are now a whole bunch of banking as service providers, and it's gotten a lot easier to launch these things. And so that's not an area, and I'm not going to say that's an area I would write off categorically, but relative to the number of companies in that space, I'm not going to back very many of them, if any of them. And there are a lot of other areas that are still totally unexplored. And so that's where I like to spend a lot of time, is with really great team in unexplored markets where the team has an earned secret or a right to be building there and understands what they're going to build, how they're going to build it. And once they're in, this is a great thing about financial services, which is also the worst thing about it. It's highly regulated, very complex. And so if you get started in the right way at the right time, it's very hard for other people to catch up with you.
Silicon Valley is known for technology, right? And then New York is known for finance. And then over the ensuing time, as you talked about, Silicon Valley is coming up and learning more about finance and kind of penetrating, using technology to penetrate otherwise like monolithic markets. And then New York is getting smarter about tech. So do you see both of those geographies being relevant in the future in terms of innovation and financial technology?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those will be the two major markets. The way I think about it is that the Bay Area, call it up until around even 2018, 80% of venture dollars and 80% of venture outcomes were deployed and realized in that geography. Now it's closer to kind of 50%. And I think it'll be of dollars. I think it'll be close to 50% of outcomes as well. And New York has been one of the markets that's been on the ascendancy as part of a share, but also like the whole ecosystem is growing. So both of these things can grow. It's by no means zero sum. And New York is also just a big dynamic ecosystem with large gravitational effects around connectivity to the financial ecosystem. And so about 50% of my portfolio companies are based out of the Bay Area. It's a little bit less than that, kind of have deep New York connectivity. But then all of them also have teams distributed remotely as well. And there's some other great ecosystems as well, like the Salt Lake City ecosystem. There are a lot of great fintech companies that have been started out of there, in part because there are a lot of great traditional, more old school financial technology companies that have been based out of there. Definitely San Francisco and New York are two of the top ecosystems, but there are also you can find great teams in lots of different places now.
Having built a community of over 20,000 founders and product managers, et cetera, in addition to the fund, what were some of the lessons that you learned in doing that?
I started really small. So the first event we did was my team demoing the product we built in mortgage, the Plaid team demoing their Plaid API, and then someone demoing an app they built on top of Plaid. And it was just a group of people that I had gotten to know, and I like manually sent out a bunch of emails to people one by one, and then had them invite some people. And we actually had a pretty good turnout. I think we had 50 or even 80 people even just for the first event, but that was just people emailing people directly. And so started very small, but with content that I was really passionate about and interested in and engaged with. And that was the kernel that allowed the community to grow, was just having something that I was really interested in. And then I think every community also grows and shifts over time. And that's one of the hard things about communities, but also one of the exciting things is that you might start with one thing. And so what I started with was these monthly events in downtown San Francisco where people would present things they built. Then COVID happened. And so I actually haven't done a an in-person event for almost 3 years at this point. And now I just have a Slack community that has 1,700 plus fintech founders in it. I still do the co-founder matching, but that's purely virtual. Now kicked that off a little while ago and we had over 200 folks participate. And I will probably bring back the in-person stuff at some point in time. And so I guess the takeaways are one, start small with something you're authentically interested in. And then two, don't be afraid to shift how the community manifests itself over time, because that's a natural thing. And so don't feel like you have to keep doing all the things you've been doing, because the needs of the community will change too.
And what advice are you giving to founders who are starting a business in this particular market?
So in this market, it depends. The first bit of advice, or maybe just comment on the market generally for starting a company. It's a great time to start a company if you have an idea you're excited about, because right now there's still lots of capital available. People have raised dedicated seed funds. There are record amounts of dry powder in the venture ecosystem. That is problematic because people don't know exactly how to deploy it later stage, but we've reached a steady state at the pre-seed and seed. And I'm seeing just as many deals getting done now as I did a year or 2 years ago. And then also it's not like valuations have been so eviscerated at the pre-seed and seed that you can't raise enough money to actually build what you need to build. We're at about 2019 levels or maybe 2018 levels in terms of where things are getting funded from a pricing perspective. So you can go out and raise money. And then this is the big difference now. It is so much easier to hire people than it used to be. So it's basically as easy as it was to raise, which depending on, I'm not going to say that it's ever been easy, but if you have a compelling idea, I think now is a great time to go out and get capital. And if you want to hire people, if you wanted to pull a staff engineer out of Coinbase, Stripe, Robinhood, or just like one of your friends who works at another company, like good luck 6 months ago. Now they're probably demoralized because there have been layoffs, they're underwater on their options or having liquidity issues around RSUs, or they've just been laid off. And so you have much better access to really great talent. And so it's great to see for my portfolio companies that they're able to close in. Whereas before, a lot of them would be like, okay, I don't want a junior engineer, so I'll probably hire a senior engineer, but it just, I'm never going to be able to get a principal or a staff level engineer. Now they can hire folks like that. And it's not just engineering roles. It's all the other roles, which are just as important in fintech, especially around sales, go-to-market, legal counsel, general counsel, et cetera. And so that's a huge tailwind, is just better access to talent right now.
Where do most ideas come from in terms of where are people coming from? Is it from the financial industry where they have some technology background, or is it like within fintech companies where they have a bright new idea? Where do you see the deal flow from?
Yeah, it's 90% people who have background in technology, specifically in fintech. And the way you think about that is the number of people employed, it depends on the taxonomy you use, employed by fintech companies went from basically zero 10, 12, 15 years ago to now, depending on what list you want to look at and how you want to define it, anywhere from 20,000 to 100,000 plus folks. And so there's just a lot more people. And those fintech companies have also reached scale, right? So they have gotten to know how the ecosystem operates and they have good connectivity to, you know, they've actually built a company that's grown. Whereas people who come out of traditional financial services, even if they understand how things work, they've never actually worked inside of a company that's growing and scaling and understand what that looks like. And so 90% of the people are coming out of the tech ecosystem in some way.
Which is probably good advice for somebody who's starting out, right? If somebody says, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur, I'm really interested in fintech, like somebody out of, say, computer science in college, go work for a big company or for a good startup that is doing some innovative things. And that's where you learn, right?
Yeah, I would. So if you're leaving school, I think the most important thing is move physically to a network rich area, which is basically the Bay Area or New York. So people are like, oh, remote work is the future. If you don't already have a network, it's really bad to work remotely because you aren't going to be able to build a network. If you already have a network, you know how to build your network and who the people are you should be talking to. And you can do that to some extent effectively remotely. When you're brand new to an ecosystem, you have no idea how to do that. So if you're just getting started, I still think it really matters to be in San Francisco or in New York working in person at a company. And then the question is, what kind of company? And there, what I would say is I would ideally try and find a mid-sized company with growth, someone at a series B or C who's raised recently, not someone who raised at like a crazy valuation a while ago, but who raised recently and is growing really fast. There aren't many of those. If you like do a search for FinTech Series B in the last 12 months, it's like maybe three names come up. But that would be a great starting point. And then if not that, probably try and find a larger, more established FinTech company to go and work for. But yeah, if you're coming straight out of finance, I don't think it would be a good idea to just go jump off the deep end and try and start something. I'd first get enmeshed in the ecosystem a little bit first.
You had mentioned co-founder matching. What does that process look like? What's the criteria? How do you do it? How do you enjoy being a matchmaker? All those things.
Yeah, it's a very lightweight process. Anyone can participate. You just go to cambrianhq.com/co-founder-matching. And what you do is you fill out a profile about yourself. And then after you've done that, after a period of time, you will get access to a list of other people who have done the same thing. And then you can filter it. And then it's all mediated through LinkedIn. So your email is not shared with anyone. It's just your LinkedIn profile. And then you can sit there and you can see who reaches out to connect to you on LinkedIn. And so that's it. It's a very lightweight process.
Okay. Self-matching.
It's not like I am curating. I will do some curate because I see the list and I'll go through it. Oh, I actually know this person and then I'll help it, but I'm not sitting there facilitating all of this stuff manually. But we've already had some great teams form as a result of that.
Awesome. What do you think are some qualities that make for an ideal match between co-founders who don't know each other? What should they look for? Their opposite? Should they look for someone who complements them, who's identical to them? What advice do you have for people who are looking for a co-founder? What should they be looking for?
The biggest thing is what skill set do you have and what skill set do you need? And then do those things match? And then you have to figure out how to align on values, which can be very hard. You basically need to meet in person to do that. So the first take is basically go through a list of people, see who is the right match from a skill set. I think it can help a lot if there's some sort of geographic proximity or connectivity, because that helps facilitate discovery about the rest of it. In the future, I hope to do some in-person events in conjunction with the kind of fully virtual version of this. And so I would say find a match on the kind of skill set side of things and then spend time together with the people. Usually if you have conversations with people, you can get a pretty good initial read and then you have to go pretty deeply from there. And then I do think if it's someone like you aren't already deeply connected to, you should 100% do a bunch of references on people. You should do front door references, people that they provide you the contact info to, and then you should go and find the manager and their direct reports from past roles that they've worked at. And you probably should keep doing references until you get a bad one, because that means you haven't done your job. And that's one thing that I try to do when I'm referencing founders as well for investments, do a bunch of references.
On a day-to-day basis, do you have somebody who manages the community? How does that work? I'm just curious. Or are you still involved? Or
largely automated. So it's pretty lightweight stuff. And I do have some folks who are helping me out though.
Okay. So there's no like membership fee or any kind of such thing. It's just very informal kind of community. Interesting.
Did you want to give an example of one of your portfolio companies?
Sure. I've done 15 investments so far, and I think four of them are out of stealth and that they have done public announcements. Maybe I'll just talk about, trying to think about which one would be the most digestible for you guys, because some of the more infrastructure oriented stuff is less entertaining or easy to understand. So I'll talk about Oyster. Oyster is doing embedded personal insurance for high growth e-commerce categories. So imagine you're buying an engagement ring or an e-bike or a bike, right? If you buy an engagement ring and if you've had that experience, well, increasingly people are buying them online. And then after you buy this, which is like the most expensive purchase you ever made, you're like, aha, I want to get insurance for it. And then you go to a completely separate experience. You like send paperwork, they need appraisals, and it takes a long time to actually get insurance on that ring. Whereas when you buy it, they know everything there is to know about the ring. They know like the SKU, the quality of the gem, like all that. And so what Oyster does is they're a platform for embedding insurance at the point of sale for e-commerce sites so that you can actually just add insurance right there. And basically it takes a few clicks as opposed to being a completely outside of the... But it's not just for jewelry. They also do it for e-bikes and other high-growth e-commerce categories, like things around electronics. It's also not just online. They actually have omni-channel support. So if you walk into a store, like some e-bike brands or companies will sell online and physically, you can actually have an in-store experience as well. And so it's trying to provide embedded insurance for some of the most important personal items in your life. And then eventually the long-term vision has become a portal into having insurance that covers, especially the things that fall outside of like homeowners, et cetera. For example, if you have a bike, your homeowners might cover the theft of that thing, but it will not cover personal injury, liability, property damage that can occur when you're out riding the bike. And then most homeowners insurers will not cover, for example, e-bikes because they have a motor on them. And so there are certain categories of insurance where you need bespoke coverage that are very difficult for folks to get access to today.
Rex, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background? Like, where did you grow up? How did you get interested in finance? And then how did you decide that you mentioned you went, became an engineer? Like, how do you even do that? What was your thought process? Gee, like, I'm now going to go code.
So I grew up on a farm in Maryland. I'm one of five siblings. And then I went to a small liberal arts school, Davidson College. I studied economics and history. There's a lot I loved about the small liberal arts experience. Learned a lot, had a lot of really good friends. I think that small liberal arts institutions, higher ed generally, even the lead institutions like the Ivies do a terrible job at explaining or preparing people for careers and understanding what options are available to them. There was a time when 50% of the graduating class of the Ivy League institutions went to work into Wall Street. When the freshman class walked through the doors, I'm like, none of them knew what Wall Street was. None of them knew what finance was. And they probably didn't want to do any of that work anyways. But for some reason, they ended up going into like banking, right? And so I think we need to do a better job with our higher education system about creating visibility into other types of careers and opportunities, not to mention like college is insanely expensive. So anyways, how did I end up in banking? I went to a small liberal arts college. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I studied economics and like finance is interesting and you can get paid. And so I ended up working at a bank. And then I learned why I hated it. And entrepreneurship was like not a thing. There was no connectivity into the Bay Area ecosystem. And so I do some work with my alma mater now to try and connect more alumni to the Bay Area ecosystem, but it's hard because it's just hard to get colleges to do things.
And then how did you learn to code? Did you go to an online school or an in-person school, or how did you do it on your own?
I started by taking online courses. So the very first course I did was Introduction to Artificial Intelligence by Sebastian Thrun and Peter Norvig, which was, what was the original name for their platform? It was when it was at Stanford, it was the first massive open online course that then became, I'm forgetting the original name now. And that became Udacity when they spun out and actually made a company. So I did that course first. And then actually through Udacity, started doing some more courses on, because the first one on Introduction to Artificial Intelligence was pseudocoding. It wasn't actually necessarily using languages. And then started taking more online courses. Then I also moved cross country and did a bootcamp. So I did a lot of self-education online as well as a physical in-person experience. And so that's how I did the most of the learning online while I was still doing banking on the East Coast.
Very cool. All right. Switching to our four standards question segment, we're looking forward to hearing your answers. Our first question is the NVCA question. The National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there is one thing that you would change about the VC industry or one policy that you would advocate for, what would it be?
I don't know. A very unpopular opinion, I'm sure, in the general venture community is there are probably too many tax subsidies to the ecosystem in the forms of carried interest in QSBS. I don't know that I would actually advocate for that to be changed because I benefit from it, but it's crazy that's the case. I'm sure that would be a very unpopular statement with many of your listeners.
Yeah, just to be clear, NVCA advocates for the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I get it. I don't know. It's really hard to qualify the benefits of something like QSBS. There definitely are benefits, but it's very hard to quantify both the benefits and the costs. So that's a longer conversation about tax policy, though, more broadly.
Yeah, sounds good. Number two, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I like doing things that allow me to interact with a bunch of interesting people, especially when it involves bringing together different networks of folks. And so I would do something that would be very similar to venture, that was similarly network-driven. But I don't know exactly what it would be. But that's something I just find myself doing generally. That's why I ended up building Cambrian and the community. So it'd probably be something network oriented. But venture is a great way, if you're someone who's naturally reflexive at building networks and community, it can be a great place to do that work. And so I have no plans to pursue another career anywhere anytime soon.
No interest in farming?
No, although I do have a sister who manages agricultural land from like an investment perspective. Maybe one day I'll help her launch an ag fund.
Do it. Number three is, who is someone that you look up to and why?
This is a good question. I think the first one that comes to mind too, I love being in the Bay Area because there are just so many super interesting people doing really cool work. And the people who probably had the biggest impact on my life were actually the people who taught with Peter Norgren and Sebastian Thrun, because they did that Introduction to Artificial Intelligence course. And so I'm like sitting at my desk at the bank, not liking my work. And then it's like, Here, you can take a course at Stanford on artificial intelligence online for free. And I was like, that's fucking awesome. And so I did it and I had a great experience. And it was funny. I didn't work particularly hard in college. I was a double major. I studied economics. I studied history. I basically had a minor in French. I thought I was going to study physics. I just didn't find anything I found particularly interesting. And then I took this course. This is awesome. I love this. And I was living close to my college at the time. So I would go to the college on the weekends and work out of a library on this course, which is something I never did as an undergrad. And I've got to meet both Peter Norvig and Sebastian Thrun, just bumping into them in various events around the Bay Area. And so those are people, you know, who did something that really helped me do something different in my life, which I really appreciate. And what's cool about being in the Bay Area is you can walk around, you find lots of those people. You don't even necessarily have to go. And like the times I've bumped into Sebastian Thrun, it wasn't like I was going to try and meet him. It was just like, there's something else happening in the ecosystem. And we are in the same place at the same time. That's also why I encourage people to move to a place like the Bay Area, is just the types of people you get to interact with is awesome.
Definitely. What did you hate the most about banking?
I think it was the realization that the system doesn't want to change because the opacities and the inefficiencies are a feature and not a bug. And the opacity and the inefficiency is actually how everyone gets paid. The easiest way to make money in financial services is to create, I would say there is no such thing as risk-free return. The closest you can get is by structuring things in an opaque manner such that you hide or transfer the risk, that people can't see it, and then you get paid for generating that opacity, or by having high friction systems where you can extract rents. And you're like, that's just frustrating. I don't want to be in the game of building opaque systems and trying to extract rents as opposed to helping build interesting companies. So that's the most frustrating thing about banking.
Yeah, that makes sense. Number four is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
The best piece of advice I ever received is people telling me to move to the Bay Area. And that's what I tell other people.
So you're going to be a lifelong Californian, it sounds like.
I plan to be and would love to be. I'm incredibly frustrated with California. If you look at the history of economic growth in the world and in this country, it is driven by people moving from low productivity areas to high productivity areas. So if you think about people leaving Europe because there was no more land, coming to the US where there was good institutions and land and other stuff. If you look at the US, people moving from following the Civil War, the Great Migration North. If you look at periods of time when people actually moved to California post-World War II, people have moved from low productivity to high productivity regions. We are actually in a new era in the history of the US economic growth story, where A, we're growing slower than we have before, and people are leaving high productivity areas, moving to low productivity areas because of the cost of housing and the cost of living driven primarily by the cost of housing. And so California is the worst state in the country when it comes to cost of living adjusted poverty rate. So it's like California, and then a little bit farther down the list, you have Mississippi and all these other states we like to look down on. And it's because we don't build housing. And so I love telling people they should move to the Bay Area, but it's also an incredibly frustrating thing to say and for some people to hear, because this state is so incredibly unwelcoming to people because we make it so hard to build housing. And people are trying to work on that, but we're like not doing a very good job. And the problem is a hole we've been digging for 30 years, and so you can't fix it overnight.
Great. Rex, thank you very much for joining us today.
On that note.
On that note. Well, we could do another podcast where we can try to solve that problem.
Yeah, that's another conversation. So,
but thank you very much for joining us today. We enjoyed learning about Cambrian and what you do. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.